Decide who you want to be. What kind of player do you want to be with 30 seconds on the line? And then build your habit to support it. If you want to be the player that goes all out the last 30 seconds and gives 100% effort and is, you know, on the attack and all that, then what habits can you be practicing in practice in your training that support that habit?
Welcome to the Heroic Minds Podcast, where we discover how to get out of our own way, unleash the full capability of our mind, become the hero of our story, and a hero for other people.
From an evolutionary perspective, we've evolved to manage threatening encounters.
I want to do everything in my ability to help them, but they make the call.
We have to do it in a way that doesn't just assume that going faster is going to be the cure-all.
When you suffer, and then you come out of it on the other side, you stand a little taller, your voice doesn't shake anymore, your eyes are always up.
Sorry to depress you guys. Self-doubt is par for the course. It's just how you choose to deal with them, react to them, or not react to them.
A little tough love goes a long way, and high expectation also goes a long way. The more you expect of someone, the more they'll do.
I have to keep moving forward. No good comes from going back.
I don't need red tape. I'm not into rules. I'm not into regulation. I'm just going to do this.
Welcome back to the Heroic Minds Podcast. On today's episode, we have Lauren Johnson, New York Yankees mental conditioning coordinator. This doesn't take much introduction because, one, the takeaways from this episode were outstanding. Every 5 minutes, there's something you can apply to your life. And the underlying message in this whole episode is simple awareness of your patterns. Not in a tyrant point of view of whipping yourself into having perfect habits all day, every day. That's not the approach. It's simply, in a general sense, how are my patterns and my habits leading to who I am? And are those habits leading to who I want to be? The way Lauren puts it, as you heard in the introduction, is when there's 30 seconds left, and that's the athletic example, or when it's 6 o'clock, the day's winding down and I'm home with my family, or when the board meeting begins, or when the board meeting's ending and it's the rising action in that board meeting, who do I want to be? And are my actions and patterns, behaviors aligning with that person, that ideal person that I believe I can be, or maybe the person I need to be for other people in my life, that hero narrative? Am I aligning with that hero I need to be for the people in my life? That's what this episode's all about. We talk about it from the athletic point of view, but it is applicable to everyone's life. So that's really all I have to say. This episode's a powerful one. I really hope you enjoy it. I will say before we hop into this episode, if you're enjoying these podcasts, you're enjoying the messaging behind Heroic Minds, I don't know why I haven't said this before, but the apparel is in. The Heroic apparel is in. It's online. I'll put a link in the description of this episode. If you want to buy a t-shirt, a hoodie, go for it. They're available online. And yeah, I'd love to see people rocking the logo and continuing to share this message that I think we all believe to be quite powerful. On the other side of things, we always have to give a shout out to our friends at True Local. High quality meat, individually packaged, shipped to your doorstep from an unbelievably charismatic, forward-thinking, innovative company like True Local. That's TRULOCAL.ca. The CEO continues to get accolades for how he treats people and how he runs his business. So it's a great business to get behind. And if you're looking for high quality, locally sourced meats, as well as frozen fruit and frozen vegetables, and you want to give True Local a try, use my discount code HEROICMINDS25, all capital letters, to get $25 off a regular size box and $10 off a personal size box. Alrighty, let's get to this episode. What is your role with the New York Yankees? And when you leave work, what do you want your impact to exactly have been?
Great question. So I work on a team of six. And my role is I work a lot throughout our minor league system alongside many others. And our role is to work with our players on breeding mental toughness and building and developing mental toughness so that you can be your best regardless of circumstance. That's really what we believe mental toughness is. And now that looks different every day. I think any mental coach will tell you the same thing, that it's not, you know, it's definitely not a, no 2 days are the same, but I think it's dependent on the needs of our athletes and our staff members. And so we don't only work with our players, we also work with our staff, our coaches and our supporting staff, from analytics, the front office, and kind of everything in between. And then also we work in our scouting department as well. So we're supports for pretty much a lot of the organization, especially as it pertains to player development. And so it looks like individual sessions, group sessions, kind of everything in between. But we, the impact I hope to leave is that at the end of the day, yes, they're baseball players, and I hope that they become exactly what they want. I hope they make it to the major leagues and they have a long career in the major leagues. However, I think the more important thing is that they leave better people. I think, when I think about our time on this earth and what it means, I think that means a lot more. And I think it also translates into becoming a really good baseball player as well, a good teammate and a good impact to everybody around you. So we hope that mental skills, they're transferable. They're not just for baseball. They're transferable into life and everything in between. And that we hope that as they develop these skills, that yes, they have an impact on their baseball performance, but also in performance in life as well.
What is the player's approach when you bring things up about this holistic view of performance and mental toughness? Because my background has led me to absolutely love what you just said, but I know there are the athletes that have the ego that is just give me what I need to be the best baseball player I can be, the best hockey player I can be. Are there people that push back with that? What has your experience been having that greater holistic approach that, hey, when you're a better person, you're going to be a better athlete?
I don't get a ton of pushback, but I think it's because the relationship's the most important thing. And so at the time of, maybe discussing more things like this, I talk about the difference, there's this idea that, well, baseball me and outside of baseball me are two different people. And the answer is that we're not. And that, yes, there's a way that we can maybe, push things to the side for a little bit of time. But if you think about it, okay, if you think about our emotions and our ability to handle circumstances, difficult or not, that we have a cup, and that once the cup is filled, that's all we got. And if we're not working on how we're going to empty the cup so that we have more space to manage and deal with things, the cup is eventually going to overflow. And so I had this one athlete once, he came to me because I could tell he was off, something was going on. And I was like, hey, is everything okay? And he's like, no, he's like, my girlfriend threatened to break up with me. And it's 5 minutes before, first pitch. So I was like, uh-oh, not great timing. And I said, okay, and how are you doing? He's like, horrible, but I'll be fine. Once I get out there, I'll be fine. And I'm like, okay, well, let's talk about that. Because again, that doesn't just get erased when we step on the field, but let's talk about how we're going to manage it when we do get on the field, because we can't just magically hope that it doesn't impact us. Because the fact is that it quite possibly will. So what I care about more is that the way you do small things is the way that you do all things. And so when you're saying, oh, well, I'll do this when it matters. Well, that's not how mental toughness works. It's not a light switch. You can't just turn it on when you need it. It has to be practiced daily. So the more we can practice these things in our daily lives, the more it's going to transfer into our performance lives. And so for us, okay, well, how you manage stuff off the field is how you're going to manage things on the field. And then also vice versa, how you manage things on the field is going to probably be pretty close to how you manage things off. And so we just need to make sure that the closer they are in terms of how we manage things, the better our mental performance becomes overall, because it's the same muscle. We're using the same mental muscle if we're dealing with pressure off the field and when we're dealing with pressure on, then when we're managing adversity off the field and when we're managing adversity on. And so that's kind of the point I like to make to people, is that you can't just split it down the middle and go, I'm going to leave this over here and I'm going to go do this. That doesn't always work. And if we're not prepared to be able to do that, then it makes it really difficult.
That makes so much sense, right? Like having a different set of tools for 1 hour and a half of the day, and then a different set for the other 8-9 hours, whatever, that we're in living our life outside of sport. I think that is such a realistic approach, and it probably works better in the long run as I reflect on it, thinking, okay, I'm going to use the same tools I always use, not, oh, let me pull out another book now so that I can throw better or hit better, whatever it may be. So when we come back to the term mental toughness, everyone, I think, seems to have their own subjective view of what mental toughness is. And what if the question to me becomes, is mental toughness about acquiring more or stripping away the fat of the, which we don't need, that is getting in our own way?
That's a great question. I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think one of the foundations of mental toughness is awareness. Sometimes we don't have enough of it. So that would be something I would want to add, is building awareness, because we can't change anything that we're not aware of. So the more awareness we have, I think the more flexibility that we have to work with what we've got. And honestly, the more realistic we are about who we are, how we show up in the world, and how we impact others, that the more knowledge we have of that, the more we have to work with. The less we have of that, the more difficult it is to work with. And so I think that there is probably a little bit of adding and subtracting for everybody, but I think it just kind of depends on the person. And then I think when it comes to maybe situations more, you know, when people become overanalyzers or they have limiting beliefs about themselves, those are things that I would like to strip away. And not necessarily, sometimes stripping away isn't the answer. Sometimes it's more so being aware of it and then choosing what we're going to do about it. Because I really believe that if we boil down mental toughness, a lot of mental toughness is accepting reality and choosing our response. You don't have to like reality. You don't have to be excited and happy about reality, but sometimes we have to accept reality and what it is, and then choosing our response to it. Like, let's be real. I don't want to fail. I don't want to mess up. I don't want to post something on Twitter with a typo, but sometimes it's the reality. Like, that happens sometimes. And so what am I going to do in response to it? Because that already happened. It's a fact. It's reality. Now I get to choose how I respond to it. So I think a lot of mental toughness has to do with accepting our reality and choosing our response. Because the best athletes, they get distracted. The best athletes, they experience adversity. The best athletes, they fail. The difference is their response is way better than most. When they get distracted, they find ways, they've learned to refocus. When they face adversity, they learn to stare it in the face and decide, all right, how am I going to manage this? What am I going to do about it? And when they face failure, they know how to look at it and go, all right, what do I learn from this? And let's get back out there. They don't sit for too long. They don't, you know, they might feel bad for themselves for a little bit, but they don't feel bad for too long because they know they still have work to do.
As you say that, it brings up something I've been reflecting on. And as I continue to dive into incredible minds like yourself and the incredible work you're doing, especially in the sporting environment where, you know, you're not necessarily sitting at a desk and obligated or guided to just continuously reflect and meditate and reflect. And I think there is such a buzz right now for mindfulness and meditation that it leads us down a path of continuing to think and not necessarily act, which again, meditation and mindfulness, those habits are great. They're a healthy habit. They work better for some or others. I'm not selling that concept. It's just that there's a lot of meditating on and thinking about as opposed to the action, where the word you continued to say was respond. So what respond connotes to me is I've thought about it enough. I know I'm uncomfortable. I know I'm in a position I don't want to be in. Now it's time to respond and refocus is the next word you used, which I love. And so in that situation, you know, if someone has been thinking about things and just, you know, maybe a negative thought process and they need to refocus, what is it that you would tell an athlete that needs to, okay, it's time to refocus. What is that step for you?
Yeah. Well, first I just wanted to make a note because you made a good point. There's a time for thinking and then there's a time for trusting. Thinking doesn't necessarily, it does not need to happen too much in performance, right? Like that's where a lot of our trust, thinking can happen in practice. Thinking can happen as we're developing and working through something. But when we're out there, it doesn't mean we don't think, but more often we're going to be trusting than thinking. And so back to what you were saying about refocusing, I actually had an athlete come up to me and he's like, hey, Lauren, like, how do I eliminate distraction? And I told him, I was like, well, you're asking the wrong question. He's like, what do you mean? I was like, well, it's impossible to live a life without distraction. We're humans. We're going to be distracted. It's built into our survival mechanism. We're built to pay attention to things that are maybe out of the norm. Like, it's not that I don't want you to become distracted, But if you become distracted when you shouldn't be, I want you to learn how to respond by refocusing. And so one of the ways that I explain this is that our attention is kind of like a ship. And a ship in a harbor without an anchor is subject to moving when the wind blows and is at risk for being taken out to sea. But a ship with an anchor, like our attention, although it may move, it's not going to go very far. And so we can use an anchor to anchor our attention back to the moment that we're in. Because it's interesting, because our body can be is in the present, but our mind can be somewhere else. It can be in the future, it can be in the past, it can also be in the present. And so when I'm thinking of anchors, I think that it goes to the past, it goes to the future, but we always want to bring it back to the present. And that's what an anchor is used for. And so there are different kinds of anchors we can use. One, we can use breathing. You can only breathe in the present moment. So when you take a couple intentional breaths, just focusing on the breath coming in and going out, you've anchored yourself back in the moment. And then the second one is you can name one thing you hear, one thing you see, and one thing that you feel. Those three things can only be done in the present. So if, as you answer those three questions, you've anchored yourself back in the moment. And then the third way is asking yourself, what's important now? If you can answer that truthfully, again, you've anchored yourself back in the present. So I'm not saying don't get distracted. I'm saying pay attention to when you do and use your anchor in response. Because the best focusers are not ones that don't get distracted. They're the ones that refocus when they get distracted.
So, so cool. And you see that too, really, in high performers, not only in sport, in the office setting, corporate setting. Really, life is this unexpected variables rolling in our face, and it's those that can kind of dip and dodge and stay grounded or anchored in. So I like that approach. You recently had a video that I loved, because we talk about emotions and thoughts and narratives on this podcast all the time. And one of the intriguing videos you had is that your feelings and emotions don't have to match to coexist. That is something I would love to dive into, because it makes you think that's, yeah, they do. They have to align or we won't be able to function. So how does that work? How can someone have feelings and emotions that don't match and still they can move forward?
Yeah, this is one that I actually know exactly what video you're talking about. It's because I hate the phrase fake it till you make it. I hate that phrase so much. Why? Because it doesn't align with my way of thinking. And for some people, it may work. And for those people, like, go for it. That's awesome. But I know for myself and for some of my athletes, it's never worked. Because they're like, I don't want to have to fake it. Like, I don't want to have to be something that I'm not. And so what I actually subscribe to even more than that, again, it's this realistic approach of the fact that you're not going to always feel like it, but learn to behave it anyway. And so a lot of people believe that it's our, you know, and don't get me wrong, this works too, right? Our feelings affect, our thoughts affect the way that we feel. The way that we feel affects our physiology, and our physiology affects our behavior. Well, yes, that's one way that it can work. But you can think one way, feel another way, and act totally independent of that. It doesn't have to, they don't have to align. They don't have to match to coexist. You can feel unconfident, but carry yourself confidently. You can feel frustrated, but act in control. You can feel, you can be ready, but not feel ready. And so we don't have to rely on our feelings to act. And actually, when we act and when we choose and teach ourselves to act independently of how we feel, we're going to be more consistent over time. Because one thing that's very inconsistent, well, I wouldn't say very, but can be inconsistent, is how we feel, is our feelings. And so if we're constantly taking, if we're constantly taking counsel from our feelings, we're not going to be very consistent. And we're also not going to act in the way that probably most of us would want to.
I think a simple example that people could, you know, sitting, listening to this, reflect on, I think an easy one is exercising, where you feel like, hey, I'm not ready for this. I don't have the energy. I don't want to do this. For whatever reason, you throw yourself into it. You're 2 minutes into the workout and you're thinking, holy smokes, I'm glad I did this. I'm already almost done. Here we go. I'm doing it. I'm getting the job done, which I don't want to come back to fake it till you make it, because I think you made a great point. But it's almost like you can behave yourself into feeling differently. Do you think I could phrase it that way? Like that's what it makes me think is, take it upon yourself to behave a certain way, and you'll embody the feelings you need to in that situation.
Yes. Oh, it's totally true. And so obviously you've watched the video, but it's don't fake it till you make it. You need to learn to behave it. Learn to behave it regardless of how you feel. And guess what? A lot of times when you behave in that way, it changes how you feel. It changes that. And there's studies out there that show that sometimes even just our body language changes how we feel. We can change our chemistry by going and doing that thing. And one of the biggest bits of motivation is when we see progress. When you make progress by doing things consistently, even if you don't feel like it, it creates motivation. When you accomplish something, as little as just keeping a promise you made to yourself, whether it was to do my morning routine, to wake up at a certain time, or to go to the gym like I said I would, when we keep those small promises to ourselves, not only do we build a better relationship with ourselves, but it actually changes the way that we view it. And it can change the way that we feel about it. And so there is an approach where I totally agree that our thoughts can have an effect on our actions throughout the feelings and the way that we feel. But at the same time, don't just think that's the only way it works. It can work in other ways independently of those things.
I think progress today too is such a interesting concept being manipulated, in our mind by so many different factors, looking at, where are we in life? Have I even accomplished anything? And we're comparing at so many moments to other people and things outside of ourselves. I think progress is, I think the point you just brought up is taking note of those little promises you've made. That is such a tangible way to think about it, of progress, is just, did I do what I set out to do this morning? And sometimes you're going to have to behave your way into doing the things you don't feel like doing so that you can keep that promise. I really like that approach. Is, what did I promise myself I was going to do, and did I do it? And when you can say, yeah, I did, that little hit of dopamine that makes you feel like you're on the path to something greater is a great thing. That's cool.
Conor McGregor talked about this after his last, big win. And he's like, they asked him like, oh, well, what's different? And he goes, well, when you the things you should do and then you don't do them. He's like, well, every time you do that, like, you create a gap for doubt to creep in. And so he said, what I did differently is I did the things that I should and I didn't do the things that I shouldn't. Because in my mind, I knew what I should and shouldn't be doing, but I just didn't listen to them. I did them anyway. And so what we know is that every time we don't do something that we know we should, or we should do something, or we do something that we know we shouldn't, we allow a little gap for doubt to creep in. And now, granted, it doesn't mean that we're not human, that stuff's going to happen, right? We're going to fall short sometimes, and that's okay. But again, if that happens, that's the reality. How are you going to respond? That's my question. Are you going to respond by quitting? Are you going to respond by throwing in the towel? What is your response going to be? For my athletes, I'm like, no, you're going to get back up, because every once in a while, life's going to punch you in the face. And you're going to need to learn how to take a punch and get back up and fight back. And so how are you going to fight back? Are you just going to be like, well, I messed up, so I must be a horrible person, we're just not going to do it anymore? Or are you going to go, you know what? I'm human. Going back, would I want to do that? No. But what am I going to do today in response to it? I'm going to get back up and I'm going to do what I know I should do instead of continue to do what I know I shouldn't. So that's kind of the way that I look at it, is that I still make mistakes. I still have, routines, and I'm like, crap, I didn't get to my routine today. And I go, you know what? Yes, that sucks. I'm mad that I didn't do that. But guess what? I can either respond differently now, or I can grovel in it for the next day and a half. And so I guess the thing is, the response is always our choice.
Yeah, I just wrote that down again. It comes up as that response, like continuing to work on your response to how you're interacting with the world is fascinating. It also brings up I think where that conversation was just going is almost the idea of discipline again, which I think is such a misinterpreted concept. I think a lot of people will say discipline's this thing that you're almost serving at all moments of your life, and if you veer off the path of strict discipline to everything in your life, you're a failure. And that, I think, is what leads people to the issue you just discussed. You can stir over it for the next day and a half that you didn't get that one thing done on your list, or you didn't do something properly. It can be a negative, this idea of discipline, at least the way I hear it thrown around in the athletic world, that's for sure, right? Like, disciplined in everything you do. And I sit and I reflect, I think, how many people are truly disciplined in absolutely every part of their life. Because I know people that are extremely, you know, they've got everything covered in one part of their life. But then you, if you would ask them, hey, do you have that same sort of discipline in your family life or in certain relationships or in your health and nutrition? And to have that amount of discipline in every single part of your life, that is, again, this ideal of discipline, which people throw around so often, I don't know. I think it can be a bit of the tyrant hanging over you at all moments. So that concept of, hey, I'm going to have a plan, but I'm going to respond if things go off path, I think is a way healthier approach. Leads me into another point that comes up quite often in your work, is the idea of changing your relationship with stress. So, right, we have this idea of discipline. We can decide our relationship with it. Same goes for stress. And you talk about that a lot. So how could someone change that relationship with stress in any part of their life?
Yeah, well, I guess my first question would be, think back to a time when you experienced stress. And how was it? How was your relationship with it? Was it good? Did you come out on top as a result of it? Or did it limit you? Did it hold you back? Did you quit as a result of it? And so my question to always that is that a lot of times, you know, building a relationship with something like stress is no different than how we build relationships with people. The more you spend time with it, the more you're willing to lean into it, the better the relationship's going to be. The more you're going to sit with it, the better the relationship is going to be. And so I think the first thing is recognizing what your current relationship is with stress. And do you avoid it or do you lean into it? That's a big one for me. I think we are all born with kind of this default setting of running away from stress. It's the discomfort, right? But an important thing is that discomfort isn't always a bad thing and comfort is not always a good thing. And so I think it's the type of stress that's good for us. I think that's the important one to pay attention to, is that sometimes there is some stress that is a good thing. That I know for me, you know, in my work, there is some stress in my work. And sometimes I have to remind myself, like, this is the good kind of stress. This is the kind of stress that takes me to that next level. Because, and I like to call it the growth zone, because there's this optimal zone of anxiety that Yerkes and Dodson kind of came up with. And it's just outside your comfort zone. That's where the optimal zone of anxiety kind of is. And that's what I like to call the growth zone, is that I don't necessarily need you to be putting yourself in so much stress that you can't even handle it. Like, you're barely like breathing, right? You're barely like getting your head above water. But a little bit of stress that you know is good for you, that's the kind I'd like you to lean into. And so the question would be, what would that be in your life? What kind of stress are you avoiding that you know is good for you, that you could just lean into a little bit? And as you keep putting in the reps of leaning into the good kind of stress, leaning into that good kind of adversity, that good kind of failure, that good kind of learning, that as we do that, we rewire our brain to lean into it instead of run from it. And that's where true growth happens.
You do a great job of making things, the imagery and making it tangible, leaning into it. I can now see myself picturing an experience that is very much in my own mind and probably mostly subconscious, that I feel so disconnected from it. But when you say things like that, it makes me realize, okay, I'm going to lean into that next bit of stress that I, to me, that really does allow you to look at it as an opportunity, which so many people, that's an ideal. Of course, we'd love to look at all our stresses as opportunities, but when you word it that way, lean into it, leverage it, learn from it, learn through it, or hit that growth zone. Okay, now we're talking.
I remind myself of that. When I'm feeling uncomfortable, when I'm feeling like, oh man, I'm nervous, this is difficult, oh, I'm struggling, but then I ask myself, like, is this the good kind? I remind myself, oh girl, you're just in the growth zone. And I have to remind myself of that too, because again, we all have that default setting to just, like, you know, you touch the pot and you're like, ah, and you want to run away. And I'm like, no, stay here. You know, this is what's good for you. You know, you're going to come out better. You've done this before. And so sometimes you also have to remind yourself that you've been here before. You've survived it before, that you can do this and we can do difficult things. And so I remind myself that, hey, if I'm in the growth zone, like, let's stay here. Let's not run from it. Lean into it.
That's money. this idea of stress makes me think of, and you talk about playing to win versus playing not to lose. And the way I've tried to create imagery around that is deciding whether to be the lion or the cheetah chasing the whatever they're chasing, you know, the squirrel, the rabbit, whatever it is. I'm going to mess up my animal kingdoms here. But anyways, right, deciding which part of that equation you want to be on is, are you working with those positive endorphins, or is it the pure cortisol and stress endorphins? Do you feel like you have the opportunity to chase, or are you backed into a corner just trying to play defense the whole time? And I mean, that's my approach. How is it that you deliver that to your athletes of this idea? Because I know for certain, I would say I don't know percentage wise, I would say at least 20% of the players I played with, if I reflect back now, I know we were, and I would include myself in that, at times playing not to lose, playing not to turn the puck over, playing not to get beat one-on-one, right? As opposed to, this person's not getting past me ever. There's no chance.
The way that I look at this is that both playing to win and playing not to lose have the same end goal. They both have the end goal of succeeding. One wants to win, and so their goal is to attack. They're going to go out and they're going to take things on as a challenge. Playing not to lose, again, your goal is to win. But instead of coming from an attack perspective, we're coming from a protection perspective. And I see this switch happen a lot, especially in golfers, when they're up or when they're like, you know, on the like top five on the leaderboard, when they like get to that point, then they go into protection mode and they want to now just play not to lose. And so the thing is, you can swap back and forth between any part of your game. And the important part is that playing to win comes from a place of power. Playing to not to lose comes from a place of fear. And so my question to everybody listening would be, how do you play when you play from a place of fear? What does that look like for you? For me, I'll tell you right now, I start overthinking. I start overanalyzing every little thing. I start trying to be really mechanical and I'm not very fluid. And I start to be robotic. I start to really highlight things that are going wrong instead of focusing on the things I want to be doing, things that I don't have versus the things that I do have. Now, playing to win is opposite, because now I'm not looking for negative things. And not to say negativity is not all bad, but I'm looking for opportunities. I'm looking for ways to exploit the defense. I'm looking for ways to attack. I'm having ultimate belief in myself because I'm not focusing on the little things. I'm trusting myself. So I'm not thinking as much as I'm trusting. And I'm trusting myself to respond to whatever happens, knowing that I trained and that I have to trust my training because I did all the work beforehand so that I can respond now. And so I think that the two different perspectives, they change not only in the way that we view something and the way that we behave, but it also changes kind of our biology too, our physiology. So when we're playing, and they call it a challenge versus threat mindset. So when we are in a threatening environment, our brain views that as that's kind of like the fight or flight kind of scenario. And what happens is our heart rate jacks up, our lungs kind of constrict, and so do our blood vessels, which means we're getting less oxygenated blood throughout our body. Where the opposite happens when we view something as a challenge is that although our heart rate might be going, our lungs actually expand and our actual blood vessels, they dilate. And so we're getting more oxygenated blood to the rest of our body. And so by simply changing our perspective, changing the way we respond to these situations, our body also changes its response to help us instead of hold us back.
And to bring things full circle, the word you just said as well is trust. You know, when you start working mechanically, you start thinking about every movement and where your fingers are on the golf club or the bat or the hockey stick. And you lose that trust in yourself that you know you should have because you've played this sport for the last 15 years. I know how to make this pass. I've done it many times. But we start thinking mechanically, we lose that trust for ourselves. Another awesome point. Do you ever run into situations where motivation is an issue in your field of work? I mean, I feel like working with professionals, that wouldn't necessarily be an issue. Is that ever a problem at all? That's you have to.
I mean, I get the question asked a lot about like how to be more motivated. And I think motivation's a little overrated. Because I think motivation is like a power plant. A power plant doesn't have energy, it generates it. And so I think a lot of us expect to wake up and just have motivation, but we can't expect to have it if we haven't taken steps to generate it first. And a lot of times, motivation comes after the action. And so if we're waiting to act based on motivation, you're going to be waiting for a long freaking time. And every once in a while, you may just have this motivation, which is going to be great, but it's never going to be consistent enough to see the results that you want. And so I, instead of focusing more on motivation, I focus on habits, because habits are things that we can consistently do. And motivation is just like, motivation is like a cherry on top. Like it doesn't like make the sundae, but it's nice if you've got it, you know? And so that's how I want us to think about it, is that the ice cream is going to be the habits and the cherry is just nice. It's a nice little touch if you've got it, but we shouldn't rely on it. Because when we think about like performance, okay. And again, that kind of light switch mentality, like, oh, I'm just going to do it when I need it. Well, that's, again, it's not going to work. If you don't practice pressure, don't expect to be able to handle it come performance. If you don't practice handling adversity, don't expect to handle it well come performance. If you don't practice failing and knowing how to fail and bounce back from that, don't expect to do it well in performance, because we don't rise to the occasion. We fall back to the level of our habits. So I would rather not focus and rely on motivation, because it ain't ever there when you need it. I would rather rely and focus on our habits, because that is the thing that is built with our training, and that we can fall back on those, especially if we've established good habits.
So much to unpack there. First off, I love the approach that if you're waiting for that motivation, you're never going to do anything. You don't always have that every day. You don't have that cherry on top. Maybe I would argue maybe Fridays are more of a day where people are jumping out of bed a little quicker than on the Monday morning, right? But we don't always have that. So don't get used to this this idea that, oh, I'm always going to have that little extra bit of push in me to get through this. And then the other point you bring up that's, I think, super important, and habits are such a big word. Again, I think talked about a little bit empty, maybe without an action. Habits are just thrown around in the athletic world of saying, oh, well, you need good habits. It kind of comes back to this discipline conversation. That's just, you know, there's not that lean into it. There's not that imagery, that purpose and reason to do it. And I think when you paint the picture of when there's 30 seconds left in whatever game you're playing and things are in your hands, you're going to feel that pressure, because that's natural. So don't think you're just not going to feel that pressure. And what you're probably going to do is fall back on to is your habits. You're not going to rise up to this, you know, perfect ideal that you see in Hollywood. So why not make sure that those habits are the highest echelon, so that when you do inevitably fall back there, you're going to be the best you can possibly be.
This is one way we can think about it, is that decide who you want to be. What kind of player do you want to be with 30 seconds on the line? And then build your habit to support it. If you want to be the player that goes all out the last 30 seconds and gives 100% effort and is, you know, on the attack and all that, then what habits can you be practicing in practice in your training that support that habit? Maybe it's putting yourself in that same position with 30 seconds on the line over and over again, and then practicing your response to what that would be in that moment. Maybe it's at 30 seconds left of every scrimmage. You are practicing that. Like, what is the habit that is going to support who you want to be? If you want to be the person that eats healthy, what habit do you need to have that's going to support that? Maybe it's only buying healthy food at the grocery store. Maybe it's prepping your meals. Every time you do a habit that supports your identity or who you want to be, the more you start to believe it. And so I think, like, the question would be, who do you want to be? And then what habit can you establish, or can you start to implement that can support it? And as you do that, they're going to impact the, like, one another.
Now that you bring up this identity piece, which sparks a chord with me, because I love talking about that and how that's going to end up fueling what you just said, those habits, and then who you're actually going to end up becoming. It brings me back to that motivation question. And I think the And I said, I wasn't sure if you ever deal with people that are demotivated in the professional space. I make the assumption that everyone is quite motivated. But for the individuals that are hit a little bit below the belt, maybe they think for whatever reason, and I saw this in sport as well, the ones that think, well, I should have been on when the last 30 seconds. Well, I should have had more opportunity. And the classic example of, well, I'll be better if I had more ice time. Well, you'll get more ice time if you play better. So there's that individual, that subjective view in each athlete that thinks they're underused in sport. So for those individuals, do you approach them the same way you just said? Who do you want to be? And what kind of athlete, teammate, person do you want to be?
Yeah, kind of. And I'd say the first question I want to talk about with them is where their responsibility lies. A lot of athletes will go, oh, well, I'm not getting any playing time. Oh, well, I'm not doing this. Well, here's the thing. That's not your job. Your job is not to get playing time. Your job is to give your coach every reason to give it to you. And I had this question come up with actually an executive, and she said, Lauren, how do I trust the process when it's my job to get them to sign on the line? And I was like, well, that's the problem. That's not your job. Your job is to give the best dang pitch you've ever given. And if you do that successfully, you're going to get them to, they're going to sign on the line. But your responsibility is the process, not the result. And so if you're so focused on the result, you're missing your own responsibility. It's not your responsibility. And so my question is, what are the quality reps versus results more important? What quality reps are you putting in quality reps, number one? Second, if you're not, you need to first define what quality means to you. And then you need to judge yourself based on your ability to execute quality. And if you do that, more often than not, the results are going to come. But we focus so much on the results, and we're so focused there. The second adversity hits, you're going to quit. The second you get punched in the face, you're not going to get up. And you're going to blame the person that punched you in the face. You've got to take responsibility, but your responsibility is not the result. It's the process.
It's awesome. When it comes to responsibility and it comes to improvement and execution, where like presently a snapshot of sport is all about that perfect practice. And it kind of stemmed from when Malcolm Gladwell started with the 10,000 hours and everyone said, okay, all I have to do is 10,000 hours. But what they forget is it's 10,000 hours of high level execution, not just doing it to do it. Oh, if I fit in a few more hours, I'll give 20%. And no, it's 10,000 hours of really well done work. But I think now that people have started to adopt that, we've almost gotten to a space where all we're doing is practicing perfect execution and not practicing where we start 10 feet behind the eight ball. I was talking with one of my good buddies who I had on the podcast, Mark Scheifele, who's a pretty decent hockey player out in Winnipeg. And he said to me, we were standing in my living room and we just started lunging for whatever reason, probably being silly or something. And he said, no, you know what we were talking about at the gym today is we always prepare to do a lunge. We take 10, 15 seconds, get ready, get your body right, make sure your shorts feel perfect, your shirt's, not wrinkled. And then you step forward nice and slow and you do the perfect lunge. And we only practice those perfect reps, which I think is important, but it begs the question, are we then ready if, hey, you're on the ice and you're in the corner and you don't have time to prep for that? Well, then what the heck do we do? I've been practicing perfect lunges for the last 5 years. I've never done it from this position. Even taking that example into a mental approach is, oh, well, I've always shown up for games 2 hours before. Oh, well, this time there was traffic. I couldn't get there. You missed the first period and you have to jump in. I know this is a huge long-winded way to ask this question, but I'm wondering, are we getting to a time where no different than expecting to have motivation for problems, we're expected to have a perfect preparation. We're expected to be in the perfect scenario to then execute. Do you see that in sport? I know you're at the higher level of profession and not the minor leagues, but I see that as an issue that's developing.
Yeah. And I love this topic because I think that it bodes to two sides of confidence. And there's this analogy that my good friend Justin said, and I think it paints the picture perfectly. And it's a bird lands on a branch, not because of its confidence in the branch, but in its confidence in its ability to fly. Sometime you're gonna land on that branch and it's gonna break. You're going to do everything right and it's still going to break. But confidence is not only in your ability to make the decision on landing on the right branch, but even if you make, you do everything in your control that's right, and it still doesn't work out, knowing how to respond when that happens. And so I think that, yes, I think that there's a part of practice, deliberate practice that we can make really perfect. And I think that's great. I mean, especially when we're learning a new skill, that's like important. But there's this other side to it. And a lot of times we go into a really big performance that means a lot and we expect everything to go perfect. And we don't even consider the idea that things might go wrong. Well, that's not very realistic, is it? And so my question always is, how do you prepare for when things go wrong? How do you prepare for it? And so what could go wrong would be the first question. What are some things that could possibly go wrong? What are things that have possibly gone wrong in the past? We can't possibly prepare for everything. But as we look at some of the worst case scenarios, what we're able to do is that when we go in and if we face them, we got a plan. We know what to do. If you're making a plan mid-adversity, it's too late. It's really hard when our emotions are really high to be able to think rationally and make a plan. Now, the more likelihood of us doing this happens when we prepare ahead of time. So I always say, if you want to respond well when things are difficult, choose your response before they become difficult. Okay, so what happens if, you know, I go to throw this pitch and I sail it over the catcher's head? What happens when, you know, it's a 3-2 count with two outs, game on the line, and I walk them? You know, what happens? Like, when you got to go through these worst case scenarios, because as we do that, we start to build this idea of a plan. And when we have a plan, the cool thing is our brain no longer has to make the decision. We call it decision fatigue, that our brain over time throughout the day, we only have so much ability to make decisions throughout the day. And after a while, we become fatigued by that. And when we're in a really big situation, especially like a championship situation, chances are you've had to make a lot of decisions. And so the better we can plan what we're going to do, the less decisions our brain has to make. And now it simply has to execute. We create a link between a situation and a behavior. And when we do that, we increase our likelihood of behaving if that situation ever occurs. So my question would be, if this happens, you know, right out of situation, then I will, and then finish the sentence, how you're going to respond. As you create these if-then plans, you are 300% more likely to actually execute them than somebody who doesn't create an if-then plan. And so that's one way that we can do this, so that we can figure out what are we going to do when things go wrong, not just how are we going to respond, or how what are we going to do when things go right?
I feel like I'm too late to now ask this question, because it just came up in what you just said again, is patterns in human beings. And we're very much, we know the classic saying, we're creatures of habit. That's why we do the X, Y, and Z. But I feel like that's one of the undertones or the narrative underlying everything that you deliver and stand for, is recognizing and learning about that, accepting those patterns, whether they're considered positive or negative. To conclude here, if someone thinks about the patterns they have in their life and they want to become the most mentally strong they can be, in a very, I guess, high level approach, how would you say people can look at their patterns every day? And where you started is reflect on those patterns, get to know them. What would your approach be to listeners that want to start leveraging the patterns that, hey, we're humans, we're not going to change the biology, we're going to leverage them?
Yeah. I love what you just said. I think that's such a great way of summarizing it. I would say, again, like, I love journaling. I'm a huge proponent of journaling. And so I would encourage people to start doing this, because as we do it, as we journal, we start to notice our patterns. It's one of the greatest ways to kind of learn and recognize our patterns. And so one of the things that you can do, if you just want to get an idea of your general patterns throughout the day, is write down all the things that you do throughout the day. You know, I wake up at this time, I then brush my teeth, I then eat breakfast, and then do this. And like, write out all your patterns and then like grade them. Like, how did I do? Are they good patterns? Are they not good patterns? Are they neutral. It doesn't really matter. And that'll matter based on the goal you have. So if you have a goal of becoming fit, you know, if you don't eat breakfast, that's probably not a good thing. It's a negative habit. You know, we need breakfast in the morning. But if your goal is to, you know, wake up early, as long as you're waking up early, some of the other things, you know, maybe going to bed matters, but maybe, you know, whether or not you eat lunch at a certain time, maybe that doesn't matter as much. So based on whatever goal you have, I would look through your patterns of the day. And then athletes can do this based on like a game or a practice too. They can start to really notice their patterns throughout their practice or a game. And then the question is, what do you need to start doing? What do you need to stop doing? And what do you want to continue to do? Those are three great questions you can ask yourself. Now, another way to kind of learn your patterns too, and this is a daily journal I give a lot of my athletes and I even do myself, is what's one thing you did well today? I always like to start with that because I think as athletes, we're kind of taught to just look for where you need to improve. And don't get me wrong, we always need to improve. But I like to start by saying, what did you do well? No matter how bad you did, there's always something you can pick out that you did well. And then no matter how well you did, there's something you can pick out that you could improve. And so what did you do well? What can you improve? And what did you learn? That's actually my athlete's favorite question is, what did you learn? Because that you can take that learning piece and you can apply that to the next practice. But as you kind of ask those questions, you can start to develop those patterns. Ooh, I do this really well. This keeps coming up. Or, hey, I keep needing to improve on this area. This is the area that keeps limiting me and holding me back. That may be an area, a pattern I want to look at. And then what did I learn? You know, then we can start to like use those experiences to then apply to next ones. But that's another way that we can use kind of pattern recognition. And, you know, patterns happen in everything, whether how we respond to people when we get feedback, how we respond to adversity on the field, how we respond to waking up late to our alarm, or how we respond to when our alarm goes off in the first place, you know, whatever it is. We can learn these patterns of ourselves no matter what kind of area of life we're in. As we recognize them, then we give ourselves the power to choose differently.
I love your approach. It's tangible. There's imagery and you can adopt things right away and apply them. So this has been amazing.
Well, thank you so much. This was a fun conversation. I love talking about this stuff.
That brings us to the end of another Heroic Minds podcast. I encourage you to check out Lauren Johnson on LinkedIn, on Twitter, because the content she provides is, like you heard today, applicable to the point, how can I improve my patterns to improve my life, to improve who I want to be? So check her out. Her link is in the description of this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Ben Finelli. This is the Heroic Minds podcast. We'll talk again soon.